From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Occupy Wall Street made for great television this fall. Tent camps, big protests, we are the 99% being chanted in cities and towns across the United States. And it's been more than theater. It's been a wake-up call, a rallying point, a threat for a target for police, a provocative challenge to the status quo. Now, camps have been cleared out. Winter's coming. This hour on Point, has the movement topped out? Where does Occupy Wall Street go next? You can join the conversation. Have you been thrilled by the Occupy movement? Intrigued? Confused? Put off? Where does it go next? Will it change American politics? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Friday, Mayor Michael Nutter gave Occupy demonstrators in Philadelphia's Dilworth Plaza 48 hours to evacuate their encampments. Here they were last night as that deadline approached.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Occupy in Los Angeles, also up against a deadline that has now passed. Here's one protester in L.A. saying he didn't think there would be a peaceful end to Occupy Los Angeles.
I think that the police will show up and they will forcefully try to evacuate the occupiers. But I do believe that the occupiers should stand their ground.
Many camps already cleared out. Here it was early in the morning on November 15th. Police evicted Occupy Wall Street protesters from Zuccotti Park, the original, in Lower Manhattan.
If you refuse to immediately remove your property from the park or refuse to leave the park, you will be subject to arrest. After the tents and property have been removed from Zuccotti Park, and the park has been...
They moved in hard, and that camp was cleared out. Many have been at this point. So what now? Joining me first today from New York is Mattathias Schwartz. He's written about the origins and direction of the Occupy movement for The New Yorker magazine. Mattathias, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So remind us of who got this started. Who put out the name, the date, the meme, if you will, of Occupy Wall Street?
Well, yeah, the name, the date, and the tactic came from a magazine in Canada called Adbusters. The founder's name is Cullen Lawson, and he worked with one of his senior editors named Micah White from Berkeley, California.
What do they have in mind? They were not sitting in New York, but they were thinking about the global situation, thinking about capitalism. There's a lot of it they don't like. Adbusters is anti-consumerist. What were they hoping for when they said, hey, let's do this on this date?
Well, I think in the beginning it was just one of many ideas that they threw out. It was, you know, in an email alongside a boycott of Starbucks and a boycott of the Huffington Post. The whole magazine is kind of a factory for generating ideas, but this one took off very quickly. In the beginning, they called for 20,000 people to show up and take over New York's financial district. Ultimately, they only got a tenth of that, but it still managed to have quite an impact.
Quite an impact, not only in New York, but in maybe 900 cities and towns, not just around the country, but around the world. Are these guys, these are big thinkers, they're sort of high concept guys when it comes to changing the way things are, changing the status quo. Are they still involved, Matt, or are they up in the bleachers now?
They're certainly involved and they're keeping track and they're posting new things to the magazine, to their website, but they never have really been involved in an executive or director, you know, direction kind of capacity for the movement. I mean, it kind of very quickly after they put out the call, people started meeting on the ground in New York on their own, beginning on August 2nd, completely, you know. So it was Adbusters that got the ball rolling. But then, you know, each of these individual encampments have developed their own leadership units.
So now so many encampments have been cleared away. We'll see what happens in L.A. Some of our listeners, by the time they hear this, something may have happened there as well, Philadelphia. But what can you tell from the chatter online, if you're following that, Matt, or the people you're talking with? What's stage two? Is there a stage two? What's the next chapter here? Is there one?
Well, there have been a lot of folks from the more mainstream or centrist left who've been trying to attach this to some sort of Washington program. There was an interesting post on the Daily Kos where Michael Moore posted what he claimed was like an authentic new, you know, Occupy Wall Street manifesto with a platform of demands. Though the folks I'm talking to say that, you know, they never heard from him or of this thing. So, yeah, there are going to be people who are going to try to turn this into a more conventional political party. And then I think there are going to be people who were involved in the occupations who are going to be trying to figure out, like, what's the next tactic now that these encampments have been cleared out, and now they appear to have gotten most of the momentum that they're going to get from this original tactic.
Given its origins and the people who first thought about this and got it rolling, do you see the option for them to go to toward a conventional political party or even attach to a political party as the Tea Party did with Republicans? I mean, there were plenty of anarchists who were sort of down in the root ball of this thing at first. Are they still driving the boat, or has it moved beyond them, Matt?
I think from the beginning up until now, it's been the anarchists who have the ideas and who got this thing rolling and have the momentum. For better or worse, I mean, obviously, the word anarchist isn't going to get you very far, on the floor of the Senate or in a polling booth with voters. But the one thing the movement has done is taking this issue of income inequality and wealth distribution and brought it back up above the fold and gotten people talking about it. So I think you could imagine a new movement in the Democratic Party running parallel to it. But I think the movement itself. Is too, it's a little bit too nuclear for Obama or anyone else in the Democratic Party to really be able to throw their arm over and claim it as their own.
Matt, I know there's no crystal ball here, but you've paid close attention to the Occupy Wall Street movement. When you look out 6 months, 9 months, a year, do you think we'll still see the Occupy movement as an active player in American politics, or will we look back on it as something from the fall of 2011 that put a bunch of issues up in the air and then kind of drifted away?
I think you will still see it 6 months or a year from now. I don't know exactly what form it'll take, but it's only been 60 days, and the movement's gotten very far very quickly. So that means that the people who got it started got a lot of really quick positive feedback, and so I think they're going to continue to work on it and come up with ways to make themselves visible. So I think it's something that's going to be around for a while, whether it's based in New York. Or whether it takes the form of people camping out in public squares, that's something I could easily imagine changing.
More to come, you say. What form, we don't know yet. Mattathias Schwartz with the New Yorker magazine. Thanks very much for being with us, Matt.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Joining me now from New York is Richard Kim. He's executive editor of The Nation magazine. He's been writing about the Occupy movement. Richard Kim, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Also with us from New York is Raihan Salam, lead writer at the National Review's The Agenda blog. Raihan Salam, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Richard Kim, first to you. What do you see in this movement? Is this a flash in the pan, something that blew up very big, very quickly in the fall of, 11, and now history books will have it as a footnote? Or is this the start of something bigger? If so, like what?
Well, I think this coalesced a lot of energies that were sort of circulating. The concern about inequality that Mattathias mentioned, as well as a belief that systems in Washington, in the financial sector, have really failed the American people, that the institutions that were supposed to take care of the economy or create jobs haven't done that. So it sort of coalesced that energy and I think it's going to endure. I don't know if it's going to endure in the form of sort of Occupy Wall Street an encampment, but it's pretty clear that this is representative of a broad sector of American people.
Raihan Salam, what do you see going on in the many, many protests we've seen this fall? A couple of years earlier, and you can see Tea Party people out in the streets. I'm not saying they're the same thing, but that was an outburst of a particular kind of political energy. We've seen another one this fall. What have you seen in it, Raihan?
I think when you look at the larger sweep of American history, you have these moments of what you might call moral rupture. So Watergate was a moment of moral rupture. The invasion of Iraq led to this feeling that elites had failed the larger public. And when you have these moments of moral rupture, what you want to have ideally is a narrative of elite redemption. The idea that these elites somehow rescue themselves from the sense that they are irredeemably corrupt. And for example, after Watergate, you had efforts in the direction of campaign finance regulation. After the corporate scandals of the late 90s and early 2000s, you had Sarbanes-Oxley, and you had another effort at campaign finance reform. Now, whether or not these efforts succeeded, you did have this story that you could tell. And after, during the struggle in Iraq, you had, for example, the surge strategy. Now, whether or not you think that really redeemed the elites that got us into the Iraq war, it certainly was a story that one could convincingly tell. And after the financial crisis, there was no compelling narrative of redemption, which is why before the Occupy movement, a guy like Eric Schneiderman, New York State's Attorney General, mm-hmm. was saying, wait a second, I'm going to keep prosecuting these banks for, you know, kind of their skullduggery with regard to, you know, mortgage foreclosures and what have you. And there was the potential, wait, there's this energy and it didn't have anywhere to go.
Yeah.
And you had Republicans and Democrats, both of whom failed to offer this compelling narrative of redemption. So this created an entrepreneurial opportunity. And it was an entrepreneurial opportunity that, strangely enough, these folks at Adbusters managed to seize. Now, whether or not that actually succeeds in a robust way for a large part of the public is an open question. But I think that that's where the opportunity came from, this larger elite failure.
Well, it's interesting to see that the polls show a lot of Americans responding to the concern about income inequality. It's been around for years, but this raised that very high. You talk about a moral rupture and the failure to find redemption. I think everybody can relate to that. People have been sitting ever since 08 saying, what? That's it? That's all? But Richard Kim, do you see here a kind of redemption emerging from the Occupy movement? And if so, what form does that take? They've been so sort of deliberately, you know, broad in their critique. I mean, some very pointed elements to it. But that list of demands a lot of people have waited for, Michael Moore may have his, but we haven't seen a unified front behind that. Do you see redemption coming here? Does it like the Tea Party redemption that meant for them bringing a whole new wave of conservative freshmen congressmen into and women into Congress?
Well, I think there's a couple emotions going on here. First is anger, and that is about income inequality, but it's also about the lack of mobility. Upward mobility has ended for young men. I think where this goes now is both in a reform-minded way. It's to pass legislation to get rid of Citizens United, for example, and it's also to build alternative institutions. That's
Richard Kim, hold the thought. I talked this right into a breakthrough. I'll come back to you on that. Richard Kim with The Nation, Rayhan Salam with The National Review. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at Occupy Wall Street. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There's the punk rock band NoFX performing yesterday at the Occupy LA eviction party in front of Los Angeles City Hall. Deadline there. It's passed. We'll see what happens there. We're talking this hour about Occupy Wall Street right across the country and whether it has topped out, whether it's past its peak, or just getting started. Richard Kim is with us. He's executive editor at The Nation magazine, joining us from New York. And Rayhan Salam is here, lead writer at National Review's The Agenda blog, co-author with Ross Douthat of Grand New Party. Richard, I had to interrupt you there at the break, and I wanted to get your sense of where this is going. Is it more than raising an issue? Is it more than a change in tone? And if so, what, how, where?
Well, I was saying I think there's a couple impulses here. I think there's a faction at Occupy Wall Street that's very reform-minded, and they want things like a repeal of Citizens United or a financial transaction tax. And they don't really differ in that way from the sort of left wing of the Democratic Party. There's another sort of impulse at Occupy, though, that is about building alternative institutions that might be, you know, worker-owned co-ops or a credit union or clinics. And that stuff is just being seeded right now. And so both of those impulses, I think, are sort of coexisting at the moment. It's unclear whether they will be able to continue to do that.
A lot of Occupy Wall Street people have looked at the whole system and said, look, we've got a crisis. The system itself is corrupt. We need to change the system. Does that cut them off from participating in the system? Is it like revolution or nothing here, Richard?
No, a lot of people down at Occupy Wall Street participate in the system. They are members of labor unions. They're teachers. They are very civic-minded in other ways. So, this is about another umbrella to raise the issue of inequality, the 99%. And in that way, I think it succeeded very well in drawing from sort of all sectors of American life.
Rayhan Salam, what about the change in the conversation? I mean, the issue of inequality, we've talked about it right here for years. It's become very extreme, but it has shown up in more and more political conversation in the couple of months since Occupy Wall Street took off, Rayhan.
There are many ways to talk about inequality, and it strikes me as interesting that the way that the Occupy movement and the We Are the 99% movement have talked about inequality has centered on issues relating to student debt and other issues that very directly impact both the people who are protesting themselves and also the kind of people who are likely to sympathize with them. Yet, you know, my own view is that if you look at incarceration, its impact on social mobility is extreme and is, in fact, much larger and more pervasive in a lot of ways, particularly as it relates to income mobility. If you look at stickiness at the bottom of our society, so much of it has to do with the families and communities that are impacted by incarceration. Yet this is a movement that, you know, for all kinds of complicated reasons, has resonated, and it has resonated precisely because it is, in a sense, service-oriented. It is speaking to the anxieties of its particular constituents. So I find that interesting. You know, certainly we're talking about inequality, but we're talking about a particular manifestation of inequality. And when we offer a critique of, for example, the excessive amounts of student debt, we're not so much looking at the structure of higher education. Rather, many of the people who are incumbents who profit from the existing system of higher education have joined hands with the protesters to say, hey, we're on the same side. Whereas, in fact, one could say, well, actually, these interests are quite antagonistic. So it's very interesting to see which themes emerge when we think of this, as I think Matt illustrated in his article, as a kind of campaign, as a kind of cutting-edge marketing that is not being used on behalf of a particular consumer good, but rather on behalf of a sensibility.
Now, you're talking there about Matt Continetti at the National Review with you.
Actually, I was talking about Matt Schwartz.
Oh, Matt Schwartz. Oh, his New Yorker piece.
Well, exactly.
Let's go to Continetti for a minute. He put this in the context of what he called utopian movements throughout American history, looking for a kind of perfection of an imperfect American society. If he's right, what does that say, Raihan, about where this may go?
Well, I find Matt Continetti's critique that this is part of the larger stream of anarchism in American life to be an interesting one. But I actually think that Matt Schwartz's argument that, you know, Adbusters was founded by a guy who made his bones as in advertising in Japan during a moment where you had this, you know, booming youth culture there. And then he decided that, well, wait a second, the methods of advertising used by brands and corporations can also be used by social movements. And, you know, he described Adbusters as a meme generation factory, as this magazine that isn't just, you know, issuing editorials and articles and commentary, but rather is trying to construct compelling messages. And I think when you think about the Occupy movement, it's worth thinking about in the context of virality. What are ideas that spread quickly via YouTube? You know, this is something that guerrilla marketers are using to sell goods. And instead, they're using it to sell this sensibility, this idea that one can be an active citizen. And I think that that's an idea that could well endure, and it could manifest itself not just on the political left, but also on the political right in ways that I think many people are going to find discomforting.
Well, on the other hand, it's a democracy. Active citizens should be, could be, what it's all about. I mean, Richard, where do you see that activism going? I guess I keep coming back to that. That yes, we've put out some powerful notions here. They've got people's attention. Some are confused. They're not sure what Occupy really wants. Others are just thrilled to see people finally saying, you know, enough with this. But where does that citizen activism go as this goes forward, Richard?
You know, there are dozens and dozens of Occupies around the nation, and each of them are different. So I don't think it really makes sense to talk about where this is going in a sort of unidirectional way. Occupy Wall Street is not an institution so much as a social movement. So it has many factions. As I was saying, I think there is a faction there that is pretty reform-minded. And Occupy Washington, for example, has put forward its own deficit reduction plan. Mm-hmm. So generating these ideas, putting them into the public conversation is one good. Then there's, you know, the encampments, there's concerns about student debt, there's dozens and dozens of issues that various working groups, for example, have focused on. So it's a really sort of like multi-tentacled beast, and it's really unclear at this moment, you know, which of that sort of energy is going to endure.
Let's hear from our listeners, lots of them calling in from around the country. Nashville, Tennessee. Sarah, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Sarah.
Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am thrilled with the movement. I think it's about time that the average citizen felt compelled, and however it was accomplished, you know, I think it's fantastic. We had protesters moved off of the courthouse lawn here in Nashville, and the next day our attorney general came back and said, they can't do that. they can't do that. They've got to go through due process of law to kick them off. So they were back again the next day. It was fantastic.
What do you hope comes out of this, Sarah? What do you expect? Do you think it will mean electing new representatives to Congress or something quite different?
Well, I hope that it goes across the gambit. I mean, just the raising of the awareness and the mobilization of the idea that this is the United States where we have freedom of speech, and as you said a minute ago, enough already. The disparity between the uber-rich and the middle class is just growing due to the greed of the past actions of those in charge, and it's been unconscionable.
And you're glad to have that raised up. Sarah, we hear that loud and clear. Let me get one more, if I may. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Dan is calling. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I want to make the point. I've had the opportunity to go to three of the protests. I spent the night in Zuccotti, and I've also been to Pittsburgh one and San Francisco.
Okay.
And I appreciate your guys' conversation about how really there's kind of like a cloud of mystery surrounding the movement and where it's going to go. One of the points I heard at Zuccotti was it'd be great if there was some public power put behind what a lot of people think is the wrong decision in Citizens United versus USA, the Supreme Court case that basically allows for unlimited funding of a political candidate.
Allows corporate money to come in a very big way into American politics again.
Mm-hmm. And I think that issue, if it's raised in the public perception, would really maybe help put some, you know, skin or fabric on this idea of Occupy Wall Street. And it could really probably maybe be a little bit more of a concrete example of what folks are upset about.
Of course, that's a Supreme Court ruling. Supreme Courts change very slowly, but let us pick that up. Richard Kim, just take that one for example. There's been a lot of concern about that. President Obama expressed it himself right in the face of Congress and the court at one of his State of the Union addresses. Do you see, try and connect the dots here. How do you see, let's say, Occupy Wall Street at some point somehow eventually affecting that United States Supreme Court ruling? Could it be as material as that, Richard?
It could be. You know, there are various working groups down there, think tanks, for example, that have been focusing on Citizens United. They've put forward strategies about how to get rid of it. It's also a symbol, really, of the sort of capture of Washington by Wall Street money. And there are ways, without repealing Citizens United, for example, to sort of control that broader problem. And again, at Occupy Wall Street, there are think tanks and working groups that are focusing on that range of solutions. So, you know, I would look in the next 6 months for some of these ideas to sort of germinate and come forward into the world as plans and proposals. I don't think it's going to be inside the Democratic Party per se, but it's going to be out there in the media and in the public sphere to discuss.
Let's go straight to the Occupy movement, at least one member thereof. Catherine Murrell joins us now from Chicago. She's a spokeswoman for Stand Up Chicago. It's a coalition of community groups there, have been very active in Occupy Chicago demonstrations. Catherine, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Do you have an encampment in Chicago, or is that not the form it's taking now, Catherine?
Well, actually, let me clarify one thing. Our coalition works very, very closely with Occupy, but we are not Occupy itself, though many, many of our coalition members do participate actively in Occupy. And the form that Occupy has taken in the Chicago area has been not so much an encampment. There have been restrictions placed by the police here that have made that unfeasible, though there have been attempts to set up encampments that have resulted in many arrests. But there has been a permanent headquarters in the financial district here across from the Chicago Board of Trade at LaSalle and Jackson, which has sometimes had, you know, hundreds of people. It won't hold much more than hundreds, but large, large crowds of folks around, sometimes thousands when actions take place. But more recently, the movement here has been moving towards spreading out more into the neighborhoods and making a plan for the winter that would involve really spreading the word and spreading its roots throughout the communities.
Catherine, you're no newbie when it comes to community organizing and all of this, but you've got a big new impetus here, big new energy with the Occupy Wall Street movement going on. What do you hope comes out of this in particular? What are you hoping for?
Well, Stand Up Chicago is a coalition of dozens of community and labor groups, and we've been working on economic justice issues for years, some of our groups have. But we're hoping for more of the same of what's already happened, because what we're seeing is that the conversation has changed. The national conversation, the city conversation, the statewide conversation here in Illinois is no longer focused on fixing the deficit or the so-called deficit problem. It's no longer focused on slashing the budget. It's no longer focused on finding ways to, basically push through austerity measures that would, cut Social Security, cut Medicare, and strip the budget of these programs that 99% really depend upon.
But when you say more of the same, Catherine, do you mean more encampments, more protests, or,
we've got
big elections 1 year from now. Do you hope to elect a new slate of representatives who might change those policies in a direction that you like, or do you want to keep it in the street?
Actually, what I'm saying is more of the same is changing the conversation, because Occupy isn't just people on the street. It's not just encampments. It wouldn't have much of a splash. It wouldn't have much staying power. It wouldn't have done what it has done already if it were just about encampments. Those have been important. It's about tapping into this frustration, this anger that the 99% are feeling, that struggling families are feeling.
Are you going to go to work for a political party? Like what party, if you are, or not?
We have no plans to do so at this point. We're a coalition, though, and so we make decisions based on what our coalition members decide upon. But right now, we're focused on getting the word out about income inequality, getting the word out about the need for job creation, and the need not to slash, essential services to struggling families.
Do you think that will change policy in Washington? I'm trying to figure out how you go from getting the word out to changing the world, if that's what you want to do.
Well, it already has. The super committee failed to come to any recommendations. It failed to come into agreement on recommendations.
But that's supposed to mean across-the-board cuts.
Well, actually, what it did in the what it's doing in the short term is making sure that Social Security and Medicare aren't immediately on the chopping block,
mm-hmm.
because the super committee was really all about finding ways to get rid of Social Security and Medicare, how to carve into those, knowing that there are a lot of politicians who aren't willing to do that in a regular session of Congress, but if you put special conditions on it, then maybe it becomes politically more feasible. Well, even those special conditions won't protect politicians right now. They know the 99% is aware, they're watching, and they're not going to have any budget cuts like that.
You know, Catherine, the Tea Party went to town on politics and brought a lot of new, very conservative freshman congressmen to Capitol Hill. Do you think the Occupy Me movement needs to do something like that, or can it have a comparable influence without doing that somehow?
It seems to be doing a great job. I mean, here we have, for example, we've so far blocked the Chicago Mercantile Exchange from getting these big tax breaks that's been fighting for on the state level. And, I mean, there are lots of other examples like that. But without having a specific, political slate of goals, Occupy has had a big impact. It's changed what people are talking about. People are now focused on the needs of the 99%. They're focused on job creation. They're focused on struggling families. The New York Times recently asked the Census Bureau to do a study on the near poor and uncovered all this important data about there are far more people who are just barely above the poverty line and struggling than was previously thought. So there's more attention now, and that changes policy. That changes what politicians talk about, no matter whether you directly have a political slate or not.
So there's the view from Chicago. Raise the word, raise the message, change the tone, and you change the politics. Catherine Murrell with Stand Up Chicago, very active there in the Occupy movement. Thank you so much for being with us, Catherine.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking today about Occupy Wall Street, whether it's topped out, past its peak, or just getting started. Richard Kim is with us. He's executive editor at The Nation magazine. Raihan Salam is here, columnist for The Daily, lead writer at National Review's The Agenda blog. Richard, Raihan, lots of response here online. NJ says, defining goals, building consensus, developing an action agenda, getting the work done, these will be the next steps. Reggie Reginald says, this will be a decade or longer of struggle and culture change in America. I expect big things to happen moving forward. We need major reforms. But Ashley writes, I'm really disappointed with the Occupy movement. They either get it together and put out a list of demands, or nothing is going to come of this. I see, she writes, the movement faltering long before politicians and big business if we don't give them demands to be met. There's the reins. Let's go to Alexander in Nashville. Alexander, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah. What do you think?
I guess my question or comment is this truly a democratic movement, or is it based in democracy, or is it really more of a the ideas behind it seem to be more socialist.
Of course, you could be democratic and socialist, but you see a contradiction between those two, or between those two in this country?
Well, it seems inherently contradictory, the activity behind it, speaking out, and I completely agree with somebody having something to say, but it's striving for a socialist ideal, which is wealth redistribution. And so there's people that are doing nothing except speaking out, where they sort of want to be compensated in some way because they have this notion.
Yeah, Alexander, absolutely. We've clearly heard from some in this movement saying that. Are you sympathetic to others who say, no, I don't want socialism, but this things are just too out of whack in the country right now in terms of distribution of wealth, or not, Alexander?
Well, sure. I think I am sympathetic to things being out of whack. However, don't think socialism is the solution. I think that that's something that won't work, but I do think that it's the land of opportunity and not necessarily the land of you can have it if you want it.
Yeah, a land of opportunity as long as we keep it that way. And I appreciate your call, Alexander. Richard Kim, what about socialism and Occupy Wall Street? Do you hear synonyms there or something else?
Well, there are definitely socialists involved at Occupy Wall Street. There is also social democrats. There are anarchists. They are people that are just members of the Democratic Party, liberals, progressives. I think it spans the political spectrum. There are even Republicans down there and Ron Paul supporters as well as centrists. So I don't really see this sort of specter of socialist takeover in Occupy Wall Street. It's really a sort of small D democratic movement that is based on consensus building, deliberation, lots of discussions.
What about your own? When you look at this and you look at the political situation, are you saying we need a dose of socialism here, or we need a better regulated free market economy?
Well, I don't think those are actually mutually exclusive. I do think we need a strong dose of socializing the common good more. We've now socialized risk that banks have put and put that on the taxpayers. And I think it's time to socialize medicine, for example, or to have a better social security system. Those are some of the ideas that Occupy Wall Street is talking about, as well as many others.
Richard, Raihan Salam, it's interesting you go back.
People, thanks for not forgetting me, Tom.
won't forget you at all, my friend. You go back to the 60s, and you had protests in the streets and lots of issues raised. And then along comes a presidential election. You have Richard Nixon elected. Of course, much less conservative than a lot of Republicans now, but a Republican winner nevertheless. I mean, what do you see emerging here? You talked about the moral rupture that's been highlighted by Occupy Wall Street. So where does it go then? More specifically,
the moral rupture creates an opportunity for a response. Mm-hmm. And there was no adequate response, or at least that was the perception of a large swath of the public. And so there was an opportunity for different social movements to offer different responses. And I think that is going to continue to be an opportunity for other future social movements. But one thing, when you look at this movement, and this goes to your previous caller's observation, is that there's an irony behind a movement like this one. On one level, it speaks to this idea of being part of an incipient majority. We speak for this larger group of people.
99%.
You've seen in the polling data, however, that there's been an erosion in support for this movement, which partly reflects the fact that, early on people were saying, hey, this is not a partisan movement. This reflects a broad spectrum of political opinion. Mm-hmm. But in fact, over time, it's become crystallized that this is a movement that has certain instincts. If they don't have specific reformist ideas they embrace, certainly they have the instinct that more redistribution, more kind of reformist activity in the direction of the political left makes sense. And so then you have this shift in the movement that happens, in which you have civil disobedience, you have an aggressive police response, and then suddenly the movement in some respects becomes not so much about these larger issues, but rather about itself. It's not so much about inequality in this larger sense in a way that many people, a majority of the public, can embrace, but rather it becomes about the right to protest in these particular ways. And so then the movement actually crystallizes and becomes stronger around this idea of rarefied knowledge. Well, we are part of this moral minority that has access to the rarefied knowledge and other people don't. And perhaps we can persuade them, but now it becomes a decade-long struggle. Now it becomes something very different. So you see this splintering in which some people who are essentially conventional, mainstream, center-left, reformist Democrats who have one view, and then you have this other group of people, and that in a way is the more important group of people to the folks at Adbusters, the folks who are trying to kind of frame this alternative to the existing power structure, because their view is that if you have 1% of the population that is somewhat radical in its views, and that 1% goes to 1.5%, or, you know, let's say 2% of people between the age of 18 and 35, then suddenly that actually becomes very significant. So while a lot of us are trying to look to what are the larger implications of this, in a way, the more significant thing is what's happening at the micro level. Is there this smaller population of kind of middle class, ex-college kids who've been radicalized and who might actually go on to future kinds of social organizing and activism that could prove disruptive, could prove destructive, or could prove very constructive in ways that we don't fully understand?
I mean, you look at the amount of money in politics, and you can see why people look at the system and say it's broken, Richard Kim. It's hard to work in that system because how do you compete after Citizens United with the great big money? On the other hand, these are very potent issues that are being raised. They can get people excited, pro or con, for or against. I mean, do you see a natural tendency ultimately here, Richard, for this movement to come into the political system of the country? Or do you see such a problem, such a disconnect in the system itself that they're going to, you know, be working outside it?
Well, if you define the political system narrowly as, you know, the U.S. Congress, for example, I don't think Occupy Wall Street is headed there anytime soon. If you define the sort of political system broadly to encompass municipalities, state legislatures, people talking on the street, the sort of public sphere of life and politics, then I think Occupy has made already a big impact. And that's I think, really where its energies lie in generating these sorts of conversations about inequality, for example. And then, you know, other people can take that up and take those ideas up. But Occupy has so far been a really great catalyst for putting ideas out there.
What do you think its impact in 2012, the elections a year from now, will be? One way or another, whether it's directly involved or not?
You know, I think it's shifted the conversation nationally in a more, let's say, leftward direction. People are not talking about austerity anymore. They're talking about reviving the social safety net. So it's put issues on the table that I think are, you know, favorable to progressives. I wouldn't say the Democratic Party per se. I don't think it's going to – it's very difficult at this moment to say it's going to have, you know, one impact or another on how the presidential election goes or how the congressional elections go.
Rehan, what's your guess? If you look out a year or nearly a year now at the elections next fall, what kind of influence do you expect Occupy may have?
Well, one obvious observation is that there might be people who respond to it in a negative way, just as the Tea Party movement, for example, began as a movement that incipiently might have spoken for this apolitical, nonpartisan majority, but then was characterized and defined as something very narrow and partisan. The Tea Party movement right now is toxic if you look at public opinion polls. Large numbers of people say they dislike it. Mm-hmm. Large numbers of Republicans say they dislike it because, again, it's been defined in a very different kind of way. And in a similar vein, if the Occupy movement is defined in this way, I think has already happened, as has already happened by some reformist Democrats who say, well, wait a second, we don't want to be associated with this large, disorderly, disruptive movement, then it could lead to something of a backlash. But I think that, you know, like Richard, I think that the really larger question is, do you have people who've been activated and energized by this who are going to have this longer-term impact on the system? I don't think that you can really gauge it. This kind of virality, these technologies that you're seeing deployed, social media technologies and what have you that are deployed in order to spread this decentralized, leaderless protest, this is not the last time we're going to see them in American life. We've seen this kind of protest spread through much of the developing world. We've also seen it in other industrialized countries, for example, in the Greek protests against austerity, mm-hmm. In Britain and elsewhere. So I think that this is the beginning of a very interesting, larger political moment that will go well beyond the 2012 election.
Let's go to Tim in Hanover, Massachusetts. Tim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I just want to say, first off, that I am a political science and a news analyst, mostly as a hobby. It was my major in college, but it's what I do now.
All right.
When I'm between my jobs. I'd like to first respond to your comment about the last liberal movement in the United States and ushering in of Richard Nixon in the Republican Party. You have to remember that in the last huge movement that we had in the late 60s and 70s, the youth were alienated by unions, largely, and that's completely the other way around this time. Unions have responded very well to the movement and are trying to co-opt it.
It's true a lot of unions were conservative then. What do you see emerging now, Tim?
Well, I see actually a very clear list of demands moving out of protests across the country. It may not be bullet-pointed on a piece of paper that a lot of people are looking for, but it is a huge anger at the Wall Street system. It's a huge anger at a mismanaged government. And I think that the protest can only strengthen itself as it moves forward, both in the media and within itself, in crystallizing its demands.
And do you think that will ultimately take the shape of political influence in state legislatures, city councils, Congress, or some other kind of influence, Tim?
I absolutely hope so. I see a huge national anger at a lot of protests. I've been to New York. I've been to Boston. I'd like to see that channeled more towards a local solution. You know, neoliberalists are concerned with a globalized economy, and that's one of the first things the new liberals within the protests are trying to fight is globalization. We want a region, you know, from what I hear, we want regionalized economies. We want smaller, more humanistic, if you will.
There's a plea or a demand, call it what you will. Tim, thanks for your call. One more, Hartford, Connecticut, Rebecca. Rebecca, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, for me, originally when the Occupy Wall Street movement started, I was thrilled about it, elated. I was happy to see that so many other people are frustrated about so many of the issues that I am, and we're putting a voice to it and getting media recognition. But now that it's kind of moved past just the encampments, I do want to see Occupy Wall Street kind of follow in the footsteps of the Tea Party, and that despite the fact that they are against the system, that it's a corrupt system, I think the only way that you can make lasting change in the system like ours, you need to put your people, your representatives in and kind of change things from the inside out. I think that's the only viable way to actually change legislation, to change the way that the system works. And I am very happy that the conversation has changed, that we talk about it now, but I think that's not going to be enough. I think there needs to be, you know, an active participation in politics. They do need to have more bulleted demands, and I hope that that is what's going to come to fruition here.
Yeah, jump into the politics, you say, Rebecca, and we've got it. Rayhan Salam, that has not been the impulse for a lot of Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street people yet anyway. In fact, it's been a kind of active resistance to getting into a corrupt system and what might come with that. Do you see it sooner or later inevitably going there, or does American history say not necessarily?
Well, though I don't share a lot of the concerns of the Occupy movement and my political views are quite at odds with it, let me speak on behalf of the anarchists. Their critique okay. is actually, I think, a very compelling one, and it's not a voice that we tend to hear in conversations like this one. Their critique is that, for example, if you look at something like Citizens United, now, if you look at the strategy here, it resembles what happened with a lot of pro-life activists vis-a-vis the Human Life Amendment. So it's very difficult to achieve mm-hmm. change regarding what the Supreme Court believes. So instead, you get a bunch of activists to glom around this bullet point demand. You know, in the case of pro-life activists, it's something like a Human Life Amendment that's very right. difficult to achieve. In this case, it might be, say, amending the Constitution so that Citizens United is no longer an issue. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you get those people to buy in to the conventional political system rather than actually building alternative institutions. And I think from the perspective of an anarchist, that is actually a complete failure. That represents these folks in the conventional mainstream actually winning the debate debate. It's not so much, hey, I know you guys are super idealistic, but, you know, you've got to get real at some point, and then we've got to fight for slightly higher taxes on rich people.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're an anarchist, well, wait a second. The whole thing is the underlying structure
you're in for a
of
bigger
our society
win
and our
that.
Economy.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so that's not even – is that not winning? That is actually letting the folks on the other side that you're opposed to – win, because that actually enhances the legitimacy of the existing system. And so I think that the anarchist critique, you know, a lot of people who are reformist would characterize them as nihilistic, whereas they see themselves as the only people who are actually realistic about how you achieve real, enduring change.
Long-run change. Richard Kim, give us your sense of what you're expecting in the weeks to come. I mean, winter's coming. There's going to be snow on a lot of these public spaces. A lot of encampments are already gone. More may be going today. What do you expect in the next 6-9 months here? Do you think it'll be lively and in the public eye or retreating?
Well, you know, I think the demise of the encampments has been exaggerated. You know, the press has been reporting it as an eviction. It's only a partial eviction. If you go down to Zuccotti Park today, there's hundreds of Occupy Wall Street protesters there. The working groups are still meeting at 60 Wall Street. What's ended is the encampment part, the sleeping part of the occupation. So I think they're going to move into more of the working groups, more think tanks, proposals, that sort of stuff, instead of the camping, per se.
So the camp out may be over, but from your view, Richard Kim, the movement goes on. Watch this space. It's going to be very interesting to see how it unfolds, and not least in a very big election year. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us today. Raihan Salam with the National Review's The Agenda blog. Raihan, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Richard Kim, executive editor at The Nation, thank you so much for joining us, Richard.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, stay warm if you're out there. Stay tuned either way. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.